Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet, insured by NCUA. And by the Lansing State Journal, offering up-to-date news and information 24 hours a day, 7 days a week on your phone, tablet, and online at lsj.com.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. Glad you're here for a Monday. I'm Mark Bayshore. It's the 25th of the month. My goodness, April. April is bearing down on us. No one is complaining. You heard about the NCAA Sweet 16 just a minute ago from NPR. This is a Sweet 16 with several firsts in it, and we'll get into a few of those with the Detroit Free Press's Joe Rexroad coming up on the program. It's, of course, the first Sweet 16 with MSU and Michigan in it. So lots of important stuff to stir up here in the next hour. We hope you can stay close. Last Thursday, the Lansing School District and the city's teachers union reached a new 5-year contract agreement. The deal cuts 87 full-time equivalent positions in art, music, and physical education classes. You remember Friday we spoke with school board president Guillermo Lopez. He assured us that those particular curricula would continue in Lansing schools, but that the method of providing that instruction is going to be restructured. Now, after Mr. Lopez's interview aired, current state's Kevin Lavery caught up with Patty Seidel. She's the president of the Lansing Schools Education Association, to hear the union's perspective on the deal. And Kevin joins me now in the studio to talk about that. How are you, Kevin?
I'm great. Good Monday to you, Mark.
Yeah, same to you. Mm-hmm. Refresh us on the main points of the school district new contract with the teachers.
As you just said, it's a 5-year contract that eliminates 87 full-time equivalent FTE positions. It's a 2-year salary freeze, plus it eliminates what are called step increases, which is essentially a salary progression scale for newer teachers. Really, the biggest issue, though, is that the teachers who normally have time to plan their courses and administrative tasks, that planning time is going away. The way it's worked for years is that the district would have teachers who specifically taught art, music, and physical education while the classroom teachers had their planning time. Now those classroom teachers will not have that chunk of time and will be teaching those subjects themselves, but the district is going to add 8 or 10 professional consultants to help them accomplish that now.
And most of the program cuts are centered on the elementary schools, but Patty Seidel points out that those teachers aren't the only ones affected by this.
That's right. There's about 20% of classroom teachers in secondary education, of course that's grades 6 through 12, that will be cut. In those schools, both the core education teachers, math, science, English, and all those type subjects, and those who teach electives will be helping to teach the other ones that had been taught before, the art, music, and PE.
How do the teachers feel about this? Do they think they'll be able to cover all of these bases next school year?
Well, I did ask Patty Seidel if she felt that her staff or her members were being spread a little too thin. This is where she is really counting on the resilience of her membership. She says that she has ultimate faith, in her words, that the teachers will rally around this new contract. They'll do the best job they can. But make no mistake, it is going to be a real transition.
But absolutely, it's going to be a restructuring of their day. We're going to be calling on everyone in the building to help and support the teachers the best they can, and it'll be a changing of the culture of the school, changing how we do things, changing the time for which we do things. But given the percentage for the TA or the ratification was 80%, that to me says we're ready to rally around this and do the best job we can.
So these changes will take effect at the start of the 2013-14 school year, just 6 months away. What, if anything, are teachers doing now to prepare for these changes?
Well, Patty says the planning started a week ago. They're already on the ground running after the union had its first general membership meeting to vote on this contract. They are already talking among themselves about how they're going to be planning on teaching their classes and teams. The district has what's called a master schedule that the teachers follow. That's still being worked out. Obviously, as we said, we're 6 months away. As Patty Sato points out, let's say a school decides to offer, let's say, 10 sections of Spanish. One teacher might pick up 6 of these units, and they'll be paid a stipend for working those classes that they normally would have had as their planning time.
Okay.
Another teacher might take those remaining four sections. So all this will be worked out in the fall, but I am getting the sense from her that there really is some cohesion, camaraderie, and a sense that they are going to accomplish this together.
And did the district also make some concessions here that the teachers wanted?
Sort of. Patty says that this was an equal situation for both the district and the teachers. The crux of this issue had been that the board was looking to close a projected $11 million gap next year for the next fall. And here's how Patty explains that.
If we were to have the district solvent with the money they needed, but if we were to take it out of the paychecks of the members, that was going to be too egregious for us to ask all of those members to do. I mean, I was concerned, the bargaining team was concerned about the setback to our members globally for that. It would have been huge. So the concession was, no, we can't do that. We can't take those percentage cuts right now. My members are looking at their paychecks now, their net take home now, and it is less than what they were taking home in 2005. We couldn't ask them to take more cuts. They're paying more and more on their insurance, they're paying more on their retirement, and that's their net income that they get to pay their mortgage with, their car payments with, their groceries with, and try to tuck a little fund equity away for themselves for retirement down the road, college educations, letting their children participate in sports events, those kinds of things. So it wasn't doable. So the concessions were made in the classroom in terms of teacher planning time.
So with a two-year pay freeze and eliminated step increases in salary, what position does this put the school district in terms of being competitive enough to attract new teaching staff in the future?
Well, that's kind of an unknown. Lansing schools, like every school district, are heavily dependent upon state funding. The legislature, as Patty notes, has cut about $1 billion in recent years from K through 12 funding, about $6 million of that in the Lansing districts. She says that has really devastated the Lansing School District, but she makes no mistake in saying or makes a clear point that that's really the reason that this new contract came to be written as it was.
Everybody needs to take note as to why this is happening. It's not happening because the school board's been inept. It's not happening because the administration's been inept or the teachers. This is a direct impact by the legislature to not fund K through 12 education. So we need to, when we start pointing fingers, we need to make sure that we're pointing them in the right direction.
So Patty is certainly putting the blame on this on the state for the funding situation. But again, her focus, as she is adamant about, is that she wants to give her membership all the support she can. The teachers seem to be very on board with rallying around the contract, and they want to make sure that the district administration is backing them up too. So they are going to be doing the best with what they have now for the foreseeable future, Mark.
Excellent recap. Kevin Lavery, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Recently, workers at the site of the former Traverse City State Hospital made a series of curious discoveries after pulling down old plaster from the walls of a former women's dormitory. They found dozens of handwritten messages beneath. A few were over a century old, and joining Current State to talk about these mysterious finds is Ian Jones, who's Director of Marketing and Communications for Traverse City's Munson Medical Center. Hi, Ian.
Hi, good morning, Mark. How are you?
I am well. Thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
How many of these written messages did you find then?
There are a variety. There may be some that were missing, but they're in the neighborhood of 40 to 60 or so messages written in different portions of the building, two principal areas. And so we think that they are messages from staff members because of the areas of the building they were located in. One area of particularly high activity were the chimneys in the attic space, which wouldn't have been available to patients. And then also a couple of work areas in the basement of the building where we found the majority of these handwritten messages written in, for a lot of them, what looks like maybe a carpenter pencil, so something that's a very heavy leaded pencil, written, drawn on the bricks. So really kind of fascinating to have a chance to see what people were thinking about, and really it spans quite a number of years, all the way from the late 1800s to the 1970s.
My next question was what they were writing on, and you just referred to bricks. It's all on brick then?
Right. It's kind of the gold brick that was part of the building. And, you know, we discovered not nearly as many, but a few were messages like this when we renovated another building that was also part of the former Traverse City State Hospital, which was also known in the 1800s as Northern Michigan Asylum. And about 10 years ago, we renovated Building 27 on our campus here for our hospitality house and found a few of these messages. And then when we moved this year to Building 29 to renovate that building for office space for the hospital.
More messages.
We found quite a few more messages.
Yeah.
Yes.
How old is the oldest one?
Some of the earliest things are, again, from the late 1800s. The earliest one I see that we have is from 1892, which is a reference to on May 9th, 1892. It's a reference to, it was awful cold outside, it was 25 below in May in northern Michigan. Probably wouldn't surprise those of us who live in northern Michigan that might happen.
Wow. What are some of the other ones, more interesting ones?
Well, you know, there are a variety of things, Mark. It's interesting because there are a lot of references to the weather. So here's one from November 4th, 1901, a fearful blizzard raging, 25 days all day. And then written on the same brick, January 6th, 1924, same conditions. So someone went back to that brick 23 years later and noted that they had the same kind of conditions outside.
I love that use of the word fearful. I mean, that is an early 20th century word.
I know, isn't it?
You just don't hear that word anymore.
That's what makes these so exciting. Here's one that's a little more plain English for you. March 3rd, 1954, colder than hell, snowing too many visitors.
Notice the change in language there.
Quite the change.
Yes.
And then some references to heat in July 1st of 1931. 1,469 people died of heat in Chicago. Thermometer, 120 degrees in the shade.
Oh, my gosh.
So an amazing range of these kinds of things. And we have everything from references to snow and how bad a snow month it was to how cold it is. And then there's some other records that are more historical in nature. You kind of get a little bit of history there in terms of the heat wave in Chicago. But there's a reference to on December 7th, 1941, Japan declares war on U.S.
Oh, my.
And then on the same brick the next day, dated in the same way, December 8th, 1941, U.S. declares war on Japan.
Wow.
Then you go to 1973, first POW released, presumably from Vietnam.
Of course.
So fascinating kind of record of history here.
You didn't find any Banksy under there, did you?
No, okay. No, we did not. We did find one actual interesting artifact piece in addition to the handwriting. It's a copy of the report to the Board of Trustees of the Northern Michigan Asylum. It's dated June 30th, 1898, and it was found in the soffit of the ceiling, presumably either thrown up there, stuffed up there on purpose, but had been sitting up in the soffit space between the roof and the ceiling for, well, more than 100 years.
It gets one to wondering what finds we might have if everybody took the time to explore the frameworks of their houses, old buildings, all of that kind of thing. There's one reference to a bunch of daisies.
Yeah, there,
is that right?
there's some cryptic references. And one particularly interesting one is one brick upstairs, all it says on it is a bunch of daisies. And one interesting thing in looking into the history of Northern Michigan Asylum, James Decker Munson, Dr. Munson, for whom Munson Medical Center is named, He was the first superintendent of the Northern Michigan Asylum, serving from 1885 to 1924. And one interesting thing about Dr. Munson is that he was a very strong believer in beauty is therapy, this kind of beauty is therapy philosophy.
Okay.
And so patients were treated at the asylum through kindness and comfort, and they had year-round access to things like fresh flowers that were grown in the greenhouses at the asylum. So maybe it's a reference to a bunch of daisies that showed up that day.
Yeah.
Maybe it's something that an employee or a staff member received. Who knows? But it is kind of fascinating to connect that back to the philosophy of care at the asylum at the time.
Are you keeping these written messages in some form, or you're covering them back up, or what?
Well, they were uncovered, and they'll be covered back up. Due to modern codes, you do need to go back over the walls. Now, we're not damaging, we're not doing anything directly to the bricks, but when a story ran in the local media, and we had over 100 calls, Mark, of people who wanted to come in and document these, who come in and take photographs.
Okay.
And it was clear that we had something that was of real interest to the community here. So we made the commitment right then to say, we're going to bring a professional photographer in, we're going to walk through the building, we're going to get photographs of each one of these writings or groupings, if it was something that, you know, maybe was all around a theme. And we're going to document those, where we found them, exactly where they are. Now, these will get covered up again, but they won't be damaged in covering them up. So that they'll still be there as little tidbits in the building that make you know it's a historic place. And then we will catalog all of this information, and we've already had a discussion with the History Center of Traverse City, and we'll be sharing it with them, and we'll be maintaining it in our own archives as well.
Now, I understand that elsewhere on the site, someone carved a poem into soft brick. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it was something that looked like maybe had been done with a butter knife or something, you know, a blunt knife like that. And that was, but we think that was done in 1929. Now, that's not in this building. That was on the exterior wall of another building on the south side of what was the former asylum, and what is now a local restaurant. And really, so many pieces of history like that in this entire complex that used to be the asylum. It was well over 60-acre complex that ran from, again, the late 1800s until it closed down in, then known as the Traverse City Regional Psychiatric Hospital. It closed in 1989. So well more than 100 years of history throughout this campus.
Remind everybody what's on the site, what's on that site now.
Well, right now, the bulk of it is going through a restoration and renovation process. The Minervini Group and really came in, saw this incredible historical relic we have here in Traverse City, one of the last buildings of its type in the state. There were 4 psychiatric hospitals at the time when it was built, and this is one of the last of the Kirkbride building styles in Michigan, of the 4 that were built, and really made an effort to say, this is a jewel, we need to preserve this, and it's now operating as the Village at Grand Traverse Commons. So it's a mixed-use development. There are apartment homes, retail stores, bakeries, restaurants, and most of that has been going on in Building 50, which was the largest of the buildings, in quite a large building.
All right.
And that continues to go on and is on probably a 10 to 12-year plan to work their way through the entire building, preserve it, and renovate it, and make it a wonderful mixed-use development that's a wonderful destination, really, here in Traverse City.
Ian Jones is Director of Marketing and Communications for Traverse City's Munson Medical Center. Ian, thanks very much.
I'm so glad to be with you, Mark. Thanks.
Thank you.
It's Current State on WKAR. It is great to be looking ahead to another basketball game this time of year. And Friday night at 9:45, number 3 seed MSU, number 2 seed Duke. The Free Press's Joe Rexrow joins us this morning to talk Spartan basketball. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Mark.
The intensity of this contest will likely be between, 9.8 and 10, I imagine. How do these two teams compare as we sit here Monday morning?
Yeah, this should be a really good game. I mean, I've already heard a few different people, national analysts say this is the best game of the Sweet 16 round. And, I think it looks like a really even matchup, especially I've really looked up front. Adrian Payne, Ryan Kelly, and then Derek Nix, Mason Plumlee. Really interesting. I mean, Mason Plumlee is about 3 inches taller than Derek Nix and about 40 pounds lighter. So they both have sort of their things, hard to move Nix out of there for Plumlee, but Plumlee is also really quick. And then, the way Adrian Payne has been playing, he's tough for anyone to deal with right now. But Ryan Kelly, Duke is 20-1 when Ryan Kelly is in the lineup this year.
And he's a
very good shooter. So those two matchups really intrigue me.
Let's talk a little bit about the play of Derek Nix. The sole Spartan senior appears to want to make his last few games really memorable.
Yeah, he was clearly intense last weekend, and I think as confident as I've seen him and probably as ornery as I've seen him.
A little out of character.
A little bit, yeah. At times over the years he'd flare up and get a little fired up or whatever. But, yeah, like throughout the weekend he just had this sort of brooding on the sideline and then going out there and really just playing his hardest. And of course, the well-documented little huddle spat with Keith Appling and just 36 points in two games and rebounding and defending and fouling people hard. So, I mean, that's exactly the kind of thing that Tom Izzo's been looking for from Nix, especially as his only senior and as one of his captains. So right now I look at him as the guy who's spearheading everything.
You also write this morning about Brandon Dawson. The stats may look the same, but something has changed here late in the season.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was better for him in Chicago and then even better at the Palace. Just, I think he's sort of forgotten now about, how many shots did I get today? And it's just, look, can I help the team as a defender, as a rebounder? And I thought his energy was really good. And, he's very athletic, and you haven't seen that as much in the last, few weeks of the season, which I think, you can trace also the fact that, let's face it, he blew his knee a year ago, but it looks like he's regained some of that, maybe a little bit of focus too, and I thought he was really big for Michigan State against Memphis with a one-point game, but he had 6 rebounds, he played really good defense, and he was all over the floor tapping the ball. Even when he didn't get a rebound, he kept some balls alive for other teammates to get them, and if he plays like that, the thing with Brandon Dawson is Duke is pretty small on the perimeter. And so they're going to have a matchup problem with him, someone giving up, 4 or 5 inches to him, trying to keep him off the offensive glass.
We also want to send good vibes to Susie Merchant and the MSU women. It's Maryland tonight at 7:20 in the Bridgeport Regional. That's on ESPN2. The Free Press is Joe Rexrow. Thank you, Joe.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Mark.
Coming up on the second half of Current State, we take another visit down the road, down I-96, to the Motown Museum and the wisdom of older women. Coming up with Joni Steele Kimberlin. That's all still to come on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Aging. Many people fear it. Many people fight it. If you turn to almost any channel on television, you'll find older women attempting to cloak themselves in youth. Age is seen as a deficit. But for some, like Buddhist nun Tenzin Palmo, we should be more concerned with how our minds age.
We spend so much time cleaning our externals, the house, making it beautiful and decorated, making our bodies beautiful and decorated. And the real place where we live, and the one thing which we take with us everywhere, is our mind. I mean, most people's minds basically are junk heaps. And so if we put some effort into cultivating the mind, beautifying the mind, rejuvenating the mind, getting our minds and our hearts into some real order and beauty, then our life would have meaning.
That's Tenzin Palmo. She's one of nearly 20 women interviewed for the film Get Real, Wise Women Speak, which airs tonight on WKAR-TV. And joining us today on Current State to discuss the value of aging is the documentary's director, writer, and producer Joni Kimberlin. Hi, Joni.
Hey, good morning.
Tell us about your decision to make this film. What clinched that decision?
You know, I was just, I think, really driven to show a more authentic portrayal of women, because just looking around and seeing what's coming in through the media, especially with these reality shows that are just absolutely not real, I was getting disgusted at the way women of any age or stage are portrayed, but especially older women. So I went searching for modern-day wise women.
And a part of the negativity surrounding this phenomenon, language always has something to do with it, right? I mean, words like, I don't know, hag, various other words really are part of the negativity surrounding language. According to the film, these words did not always elicit resistance. When did the wise old woman become the hag?
You know, I did look somewhat into the history of it, but it is not my specialty. But I know that centuries and centuries ago, the words hag and crone did, as you say, have very positive connotations. For instance, hag, which most women would dread to be called a hag,
yeah,
that meant the wise one or the holy one. And crone came from words that meant the crowning time or the crowning most auspicious years of your life. And what's really interesting is in almost every single culture, if you go back and look at the traditional literature, wisdom is almost always represented as female. Of course, many of us are, you know, saying no surprise there. But you know, the thing is that was the reality, and I think it's still the reality. It's just a perception that's skewed. And I wanted to use the media to change that negative perception and really bring some authenticity to bear on what are the really fantastic, fabulous lives that older women are leading and the huge contributions that they're making and that they have to make.
It was obviously important for you to have a really wide variety of women in your film. We see women from all different kinds of backgrounds, researchers and actresses and Nobel Peace Prize winners. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I think, you know, we wanted a really rich mosaic to really represent what's out there. And one of the fun parts of the film is a local dance teacher near where I live in Connecticut. And, you know, she's not famous. She's our every woman. And she can still do the splits, full-on splits, in her early 80s. She lost her husband to a long illness. And then she went on Yahoo Personals, and that's where she got her boyfriend. And her picture was of herself posing with her Tai Chi sword. So she's just completely, you know, a spunky woman living life to the fullest. And then we have Jane Fonda, we have Della Reese, we have the spiritual activist Marianne Williamson, we have a well-known poet, Nikki Giovanni. So it really runs the spectrum of all different kinds of women, but the one thing they have in common is that they're all propelled by this really an inner fire to step up to plate with that wisdom and that experience and to really try and make their world a better place.
The dancer you're referring to, I believe her name is Roberta Pollard, correct?
Yes. Yes.
Now, was she always like that, Joni, or did she become that person over time?
Well, I think she had those you know, definitely seeds of spunkiness in her personality. But she did say something very interesting. She said, you know, after she lost her husband, and then she, you know, these are words that you think you don't say at this stage of life. She was a grandmother, but she said she had to decide what she wanted to do with her life. You know, what do I want to do when I grow up? You know, you're still saying that. This journey never ends. And she said, like, she really felt at that point completely on her own, I'm all grown up now. And she made the choice to, she said, you know, you can't just sit around and mope and whine. We all have losses by this stage of life, you know, sometimes big, terrible, horrible losses. And you've just got to get out there and, you know, meet new people, find new things to do, and, you know, really find out what your own passions are.
It's so important to look ahead as opposed to look. Aren't we at risk when we spend too much time looking backward as opposed to forward?
Absolutely. You know, every single one of us is on a journey, and those journeys are made up of stages. And the thing is, you can't really enjoy where you are in your journey now if you're trying to hold on to something in the past. And I think a lot of women get stuck there. Instead of celebrating, you know, this is where I am now with this wisdom and experience and, you know, love to give and energy. As Della Reese says, we still have so much energy. And they're just letting this negative media baloney come in, and they're focusing on their wrinkles and, you know, and I don't look like this anymore and no one's going to want to hear me. And so you're right. You know, it's just so important to be really authentic where you are right now.
Who is this film for? I mean, are you hoping that young girls see this and lose any apprehension of aging, or that older women see it and embrace their age, or both, or what?
Well, that's just music to my ears, because we really do want to reach out to younger women, and that's one of my goals, is to get it into the educational market. You know, we're playing in much of the country on PBS this month, but I know that a lot of women my age, I'm speaking to the choir, and they do need to be empowered, and I do want them to step up to plate. But one of the most heartwarming experiences of making this film is going to film festivals and having younger women come up to me with tears in their eyes, and they're saying, we want everyone our age to see this. And I'm talking about 20-somethings and college students. And they really need to know that there's this whole landscape to life, and that life really does just get better. So we created the film in a way that we thought it would engage the attention, hold the attention of a younger person. And now we just have to get it to them.
What did you take away as the, you know, as the auteur of this whole project? What did you take away personally from making this film?
Oh, my Lord, I get constant inspiration. And, you know, I have to say, I was on my own journey, obviously, as I made the film. It was at least 5 years. And during that course of time, I lost my own wise woman. You know, my mother went into hospice, and of course, I was so busy making a film and having children and then flying back and forth to care for my mother. And during that time is when I was working on the edit, and I had all the wisdom of these, you know, 20-plus women that we interviewed just really lifting me up and propelling me along. And daily, something that one of them said comes to me. For instance, Della Reese said, if you're making this transition without something deeper, then you grieve for what you left behind. You know, you grieve for the loss of your youth and your youthful looks. But she said, if you have something deeper, then you can make this transition successfully and with joy. So, you know, while I made the film, I think that's an important time in a woman's life, my own age, approaching 50 and now in my 50s, and suddenly those wrinkles are really there for me. And it's really wonderful to have that tape playing over and over in my head of Della Reese saying, you know, you really have to have something deeper. And it refocuses me on a daily basis.
Joni Kimberlin is the director and producer of the film Get Real, Wise Women Speak. That documentary airs tonight on WKAR-TV. Joni Kimberlin, best of luck to you.
Thank you so much.
It's Current State on WKAR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mark Bayshore. Soon, a little piece of Detroit's history will join the marquees on Broadway. Motown the Musical will debut in New York in April. But if you can't make it to Broadway, you can find the story of Motown on display at the Motown Museum. WKAR Scott Pohl toured the museum with president and CEO of the Motown Museum, Alan Rawls. Rawls jokes that he was not always a behind-the-scenes guy.
I had a group, and we auditioned for Motown twice. And I tease Mickey Stevenson, who's the A&R director, that you guys never gave me a contract because they knew they could get me for free. So now I get to sit here every day and do what I enjoy more than anything else in the world. And I'm inspired by photographs like the one we're looking at right now with Berry Gordy, Howlin' Dozier Howlin' and the Supremes out on the front lawn, making music and love and in a professional sense. But that's the kind of thing that really inspires me, is all of the electricity that happened here during the 60s and continues to happen today.
I should point out to listeners that we haven't yet entered the museum. I've been mm-hmm. through the museum once before, several years ago. Mm-hmm. We are in the building next door to the museum.
Mm-hmm. This is also one of Motown's office buildings. I'm not sure who occupied this back during the 60s, but we actually owned seven houses along West Grand Boulevard on the south side of the street, as well as one across the street where artist development took place. So that's where they would have a rehearsal hall, and they'd work on singing and choreography and harmony. So this was a big complex. You know, I can't recall exactly how many employees we had, but several thousand. And so at some point we outgrew this space also and purchased a building on Woodward and the Fisher Freeway. So largest African-American corporation in the entire world while it was in existence. And we're very, very proud of it.
Part of what I loved about listening to CKLW mm-hmm. was back in those days, they would play your rock and roll songs mm-hmm. by the Rolling Stones and the mm-hmm. Beatles, and the next track might be Marvin Gaye
yep.
or
mm-hmm.
someone like that,
right.
and a huge Motown mm-hmm. presence.
Right.
And so a young fellow like me grew up uh-huh. with a love for both kinds of music
sure.
from
mm-hmm.
listening to CKLW.
Absolutely, yeah, and I did the same thing because of that, you know, crossover. You know, I might have not have been aware of the Beatles or the Rolling Stones or some of the other smaller groups like Hermit's Hermits or something like that. But then because of CKLW, and I mean, they were probably one of the first crossover stations where you would hear all good music all the time. And they were very, very instrumental in helping to break records for our Motown during the early days. I'm sure you remember a guy by the name of Robin Seymour. He had a radio show as well as a TV dance show. He was kind of the Dick Clark of Detroit. And he had a show, started out as Teen Town, then became Swingin' Time. And, I mean, that was a show that you rushed home to see every day, especially if somebody from Motown was going to be on there.
I know from time to time celebrities, as they come through Detroit, mm-hmm. will pay a visit to the museum. Perhaps the most famous in the last year or so was Paul McCartney stopping by.
That's right. It's
got to be hugely gratifying to know that Hitsville, USA still holds a place in the hearts of people like that.
Yeah, it is very gratifying. Yeah, just as an aside with Paul, I mean, he was so bowled over by what he experienced here that he actually offered to restore our Steinway piano. He did that and along with a fundraiser for us in New York City. And so we're very, very thankful to Paul and Mr. Gordy as well, because they jointly held that fundraiser for us. Kid Rock loves to come by this place. George Clinton was here around Thanksgiving, right? In fact, the day after he made his appearance at the Thanksgiving Day football game. And Chuck D from Public Enemy, as well as a lot of Motown alumni. They still stop by all the time. Otis Williams, I've seen him several times when he's in town. G.C. Cameron, some of you may know who he is. He was originally with one of the Spinners, and then had a stint as a Temptation as well. Duke from the Four Tops, you know, he's an all-time favorite. He stops by, and then the ladies from the girl groups have been by as well. Martha is an all-time favorite. She comes by all the time. And we are always happy to invite our alumni, if you will, back again. You know, it's a homecoming for all of us.
That was Alan Rawls, president and CEO of the Motown Museum, guiding WKAR's Scott Pohl on a tour of the Motown Museum. Its current state. MLive's Angela Whitrock joins the program every Monday morning to stir up area business and the economy. You didn't run yesterday, but you ran over the weekend.
I did, yes, indeed. The Ronald McDonald race for the House on Saturday.
And you're planning on the half marathon for the Lansing Marathon?
Yep, the Lansing half marathon and then a bunch the rest of the summer.
That's pretty ambitious. Well done. Well, we will learn more about Mayor Virge Bernero's proposed budget tonight. He'll present it to the council, and this process, obviously, it's got a ways to go even after tonight, but we have learned more about how the mayor feels about infrastructure for Lansing. Tell us about that.
Yeah, Lansing Mayor Virge Bernero released a statement on Friday indicating that he plans to propose about a $3.3 million investment in roads and sidewalks. Sidewalk repair had been a big sticking point last year during the budget. There had been an attempt around budget time to enact a new millage proposal that would allow for a little more funding for sidewalk repair. There are, you know, hundreds and hundreds of miles of sidewalk in the city. A lot of them are badly in need of repair or replacing. And there are still some spots in the city where there aren't sidewalks. And as anybody who drives roads in Michigan knows, roads are always a problem. State funding for roads has been down for years now. So, you know, I think Mayor Bernero said it's time for the city to pony up some more cash for roads. There has been the millage proposal the millage in action that allowed the city to fund a little bit more, but still more is necessary. And so we'll see exactly how much above and beyond it is from last year today.
And they face a $9 million budget deficit here for this next fiscal year. But coming on the heels of the Financial Health Team report, that team, of course, as was widely reported, actually recommended a cut of around $12 million for this next budget. So we're waiting to see whether Verge follows suit and actually recommends more than $9 million in cutting, correct?
Correct, yeah. And that's going to be a fight. You know, there was a proposed cut in the Hollister proposed budget from the Financial Health Team that would have cut the Lansing Fire Department, $2 million, the Police Department, $1 million, but then, as you mentioned, would increase investments in other areas, $3 million, which again would need to be offset somehow. So one of the actual additional investments they proposed was $1 million into upgrading the technology in City Hall, really to make the operations more efficient, which is important when you have cut over 30% of your staff in the past few years. You know, they're doing, as Mayor Bernero says, more with less, and at some point, you know, upgrading your technology becomes a priority, it seems.
And we want to point out that City Councilperson Carol Wood is slated to join the program tomorrow for a closer look at the Bernero budget. She explained to me on Friday that what we'll see tonight are departmental appropriations, not detailed. She referred to them as line item, and you know what she means. These are departmental mm-hmm. numbers, not line item specific project numbers, right?
Right. What we'll see is something like police and fire, $35
million. Right.
Retirement fund, $10 million. Something, I mean, these are just numbers I'm making up. Don't take these as gospel. But we won't see something that says, you know, $50,000 for technology in City Halls, you know, first floor office for tax collections. That we'll see as this process unfolds between now and May 20th when the council has to pass the budget.
You've read these things, I can tell.
I have. I'm a nerd.
Your colleague Jonathan Osting at MLive has reported a really interesting development involving a pair of Republican senators from the greater Lansing area. Senators Rick Jones and Joe Hewn are apparently leading an effort to repeal the state's new pension tax and to reinstate homestead property tax credits. Now, Jones and Hewn are two of five Republicans, at least, who did vote against that proposal in 2011. They're making it an issue again. What's going on?
Well, you know, Rick Jones says he's at the cusp of that exemption where, because he was born at a certain point in 1952, this doesn't affect him. His pension will not be taxed. But he says that he thinks it's unfair that, you know, anyone who's born after 1952, even by a couple of months, is going to have this tax taken out of their pension accounts. Now, it's, you know, it's going to be a fight, obviously. I don't know that there's a tremendous amount of political will in the House, even if the Senate gets this through, or even that Governor Snyder would sign it. Mm-hmm. You know, we could see maybe his... a veto, dare we say? I don't know what's going to happen.
It barely passed in 2011. In fact, it took a tiebreaker by the lieutenant governor, Brian Calley, to pass it. It was tied 19-19. Is it known whether, I guess it, this boils down to whether other Republicans who may have voted yes for the proposal at the time are having second thoughts as well?
That's possible. And with the pickup of a few seats in the last election in the House by Democrats, right, that could change things a bit. And Tim Skubick commented this morning, he has a column up on MLive as well, that the five Republican senators who are backing this are all up for re-election this year. So there's a little bit of political payback now for that vote that could be coming due in the fall.
I should point out also here, switching to East Lansing, the downtown East Lansing development, this vetting process continues. Former Mayor Doug Jester is the head of a panel that is assigning scores to all of the six projects that have been submitted, or proposals that have been submitted for the downtown area, the hub of which is the former Citizens Bank. And Current State learned yesterday that Doug will propose this Wednesday that his committee invite the developers themselves to their group's meeting on Wednesday, April 10th. Doug is the former mayor of East Lansing. He told me yesterday about this. He emphasizes that whether this actually happens depends on the response of his committee to the idea, but he does acknowledge that he will present it. Right now, they're already on track to score all of the proposals according to various criteria, and they're also scheduled to announce the scores at this April 10th meeting. If the committee agrees with Jester, then the actual developers could also appear and answer questions at that meeting. But in the meantime, they've got another meeting scheduled for this Wednesday.
Correct. And one of the things that the committee is really pushing for this time around is a lot more transparency on the part of the developer. They want no business of developers hiding behind various LLCs. They've requested that every developer who is an LLC name each member of the LLC. And if an LLC is a member of an LLC, they want them to sort of unpack those nesting dolls, if you will, until they get to the final point where there are no more LLCs. Basically, what they want to know is who is behind these proposals. They don't want any surprises. They don't want some of the accusations that were leveled at them during the last debacle with City Center 2 to come back around this time. So I think what we're really seeing is a tremendous effort at transparency this go around.
Briefly, what are you working on today?
Oh, goodness gracious. Well, I'll be at City Hall tonight updating everyone on the budget goings on. So you can look for a live coverage coming up on MLive on that. Beyond that, we'll be looking into the same things that we've been chatting about today, what's happening next with those Park District proposals.
Excellent. Thanks, Angela.
Thanks, Mark.
Coming up Tuesday on Current State, we'll discuss the Lansing budget. Carol Wood will be in here, City Council President, and we'll speak with mental health advocate and former U.S. Representative Patrick Kennedy. That and more tomorrow on Current State. The executive producer of our program is Peter Wharf. Joe Lindstroth is the producer. Thanks to Aaron Young for engineering and Emmanuel Berry and Yensia Wong for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR. We'll be right back.
Support for WKAR is provided by Fluke Hearing, featuring American-made products that provide hearing technology for every lifestyle and life stage, with 8 locations throughout mid-Michigan. FlukeHearing.com. And by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. Alumni.msu.edu.